Okay, so let us continue where we left off yesterday. So we are looking at the four satipatthanas, the four applications of mindfulness, or the four mindfulness meditations, whatever you want to call them. We're going to have a look at a couple of more suttas before we then move on to the Anapanasati Sutta later on, and to see how the mindfulness of breathing is done in detail. Before we do that, we'll look at a couple of more short ones just to give a little bit more of overview of how this works. And this next one, the sutta, is from the Samyutta Nikaya 47. That is the Satipatthana Samyutta, the connected discourses on Satipatthana. And if you want to understand Satipatthana properly, you really have to read that particular section of the Samyutta Nikaya, because just reading the Satipatthana Sutta is not really enough, because it gives you just a one-sided view of what Satipatthana is about. If you want to understand it fully, you have to read much more broadly in the suttas, and especially the Satipatthana Samyutta is very useful for getting a broad understanding of what Satipatthana is all about. So this little sutta gives you one angle on this, and there are many other angles as well. So this sutta is called A Monk, and it goes as follows. At one time, the Buddha was staying near Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. Then a mendicant went up to the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Sir, may the Buddha please teach me the Dhamma in brief. When I've heard it, I will live alone, withdrawn, diligent, keen, and resolute." So this is a kind of a common theme you see in the suttas. You see a monk or a nuns as well come up to the Buddha and they ask him, "Please give me a brief teaching that I can kind of use as a for contemplation, to think about and to use it so I can practice all the way to become an arahant." And this is quite a common thing that you see in the suttas. So it's quite nice to have Buddha, you know, this Buddha is there and you can go to him at any time and ask for a special teaching. That's what they did in those days. It's quite, quite neat in a sense, I suppose. And you notice the words that he uses there, to dwell, withdrawn, and diligent. These words are kind of quite important words in Pali. Alone is eka. Eko means like one. Withdrawn. Actually, what is withdrawn here? That's a good question. I'm not sure what withdrawn is in this case. I don't think it's viveka. I think it might be, I wonder, it's patisalano or something like that might be. I'm not sure which word is used. There are quite a few words which has that meaning here. So diligent anyway is apamano, and keen and resolute. This is pahitato is one of those words. So it means that you are basically energetic. So the idea of being energetic and heedful, in other words, careful in your practice, and diligent, and withdrawn. It's always withdrawn. You will notice that almost everywhere in the suttas, being withdrawn and alone is the thing that the monastics do to kind of make sure the path happens as quickly as possible. That's how you end up using these teachings to attain arahantship. It's a very strong theme throughout the suttas. And these words you see here are very commonly found everywhere for anyone who is really, really serious about meditation practice. Solitude, and then to be careful and heedful, and then having the energy, the resolute and keen, the energy aroused. And then the Buddha replies. He says, "This is exactly how some foolish people ask me for something. But when the teaching has been explained, they think only of following me around." Imagine being told that by the Buddha. You probably feel a bit deflated afterwards when you hear that from the Buddha. This, you can imagine that this would happen. People would follow the Buddha around. There is many examples in the suttas of that. Sometimes he would have a large gathering, traveling around with him, And the Buddha is not too impressed with that. Yeah? He doesn't really encourage people to follow him around. He encouraged people to go into solitude and practice the teaching properly. Yeah? But you can see why people do this. It's very natural. You know, you come to some spiritual master, yeah, and they make you feel good. Yeah, in their presence you always feel relaxed, you feel at ease. They don't judge you, they don't give you a hard time at all. This is one of those beautiful things about being with somebody who has practiced the path a long way. They are so very non-judgmental. You can really relax in their presence. A classic example of that is the one when Ajahn Brahm talks about, when he talks about him visiting one of those very famous monks in Thailand, a monk called Ajahn Tet. And he says that when he went to visit Ajahn Tet, he was rumored to be an arahant by many people. He had this enormous kind of building called the Mandapa that was built for him in his monastery in the northeast of Thailand. And Ajahn Brahm, when he only had 5 rains as a bhikkhu, he went to visit this very famous monk because he had a chance to travel around the northeast of Thailand. That's where all the most famous monks in Thailand used to be. And he goes to this monastery, and then he goes to this mandapa because he's heard that Ajahn Tet is sitting in this enormous building built by the king of Thailand. And he goes in and he opens the door. He has all these questions that he wants to ask Ajahn Tet. Then he goes in and he looks around. Oh, there's nobody there. And then he leaves and think, wait a minute, wasn't there someone in the corner? And he goes back in, has another look, and there he sees Ajahn Tet sitting in the corner over there, far away. But because he's such a very well practiced monk, and he may very well have been an arahant, that's what you hear anyway, he doesn't make anything out of himself. He's just there, and he doesn't really, he doesn't have any need to show himself or to express his ego. There is no ego anymore. Ego is completely gone. So because of that, you fade into the background. Arahants tend to fade into the background. You can barely tell them from the wall. They look like the wall, basically. So Ajahn Brahm then, he's there. Okay, so he goes in. And then he bows down. And then he says that it was so peaceful to be in the presence of somebody like that. Because there's no judgment, there's no sense of self, there's no kind of... it's just an incredibly peaceful experience. So all these questions that disappear. Questions didn't have any questions anymore. So he just bows down to him, doesn't know what to say. Questions are gone. So he feels a bit silly, doesn't have anything to say. Then they can just have a very gentle conversation together. And this is the beauty of being with someone who has practiced a long way, is this kind of complete lack of judgment and a complete sense of acceptance, because they know that you are just a heap of conditions, and because they know that, they will just have compassion. And this is exactly the same thing with the Buddha. One of the qualities of the Buddha is that he has the Maha Karuna, the great compassion, because he understands that we're all trapped in our personalities, trapped in our conditioning, trapped in our habits. For that reason, the compassion is complete. And no judgment of anyone, just compassion all the time. It's a very beautiful thing here. But the Buddha here is kind of telling him that this is not the way, the right thing, just to hang out with the Buddha. Get yourself into the forest, and practice meditation problems. But what he's saying is obviously saying this to give a little bit of impact on this monk, so he really listens. The monk says, "Sir, may the Buddha teach me the Dhamma in brief. May the Holy One," the Sugato is the Holy One here, "teach me the Dhamma in brief. Hopefully I can understand the meaning of what the Buddha says. Hopefully I can be an heir of the Buddha's teaching here." So now he's feeling a bit desperate. He's kind of saying, "Please, please teach me here." He's kind of realizing that there's something serious going on. And then the Buddha replies, "Well then, mendicant, you should purify the starting point of skillful qualities." What is the starting point of skillful qualities? It is well purified ethics and correct view. When your ethics are well purified and your view is correct, then you should develop the 4 kinds of mindfulness meditation. Here again he is pointing out the things that are necessary to develop for mindfulness meditation, for satipatthana to be possible. And I have mentioned these things before, the idea of right view or straight view, and then the idea of morality or ethics or sila or whatever you want to call it. These two are here called sila, and the correct view is called ujjuka ditti, quite literally means straight view. And if you think about the Noble Eightfold Path, the Noble Eightfold Path starts out with right view, which is equivalent here to straight view, ujjuka ditti, in this particular sutta. And after that, it has all the factors of morality, starting with right intention. Right intention is kind of leaning your mind in the right way, and then all the factors of ethics come after that. And right effort is really also a factor of ethics. It's the ethics of the mind. So it kind of fits, what he says here, fits very well with the Noble Eightfold Path. First of all, you have to practice the first six factors. You have to get those sorted out to at least to some extent. And only then does Satipatthana meditation or mindfulness meditation become possible. You have to have these things established first of all. This is a very important point. So if you find that your meditation is not working fully, or you plateau at a certain point, it doesn't go any further, or whatever it is, then always come back to these two things in particular: right view, correct view, and ethics. So you have to look at your conduct. Can you improve your conduct in any way? And usually you can, especially the mental conduct is where we can always kind of make some improvements. And that is what you have to come back to. And you have to be, if you are going to be serious about meditation practice, this is the sort of thing that you have to do. And then you kind of judge yourself, or you look at yourself year after year, and to see if the progress is there. If it is not there, go back to these basic factors and ask yourself what you can do. And I think sometimes the idea of right view or correct view is not appreciated enough by people, because that right view, what it does, it means that you emphasize the spiritual path more. The more clarity you have about the nature of the world, the nature of the practice of the path, the more you prioritize the spiritual practice. And when you prioritize the spiritual practice, that is where meditation starts to happen. When you sit down, you don't think about the worldly things anymore, because you realize they are actually quite irrelevant. That is not what is going to give you any form of success or any purpose or any aim or anything that is useful. So when you sit down, you just leave it all, all disappears, because it's irrelevant. And then you focus on the meditation subject instead. And your mind naturally becomes peaceful. And that is why why the stream entrance, generally speaking, has so much more easy for a person who is a stream mentor to get into meditation practice, because right view is already established. They already see the world in the right way. They know where suffering is found, they know where happiness is found, and because they know that, they can just give up all the stuff that is suffering straight away. And all the stuff that is suffering is all the stuff that stops you from entering into samadhi. So you can give it up like that. That's why if you are a stream mentor, you can, and you are on retreat or whatever, and you're not too bothered by the world around you, you can go into samadhi very, very fast. This is one of the ways that you know that you have insight into the Dhamma, because you know where happiness is, where suffering is, and so you can let go very quickly. This is the whole purpose of insight. So if you have a hard time getting into jhanas, even on retreat, you can be pretty sure you're not a stream entry here. This is one of the ways to actually check whether you have that profound insight or not. Because you understand the nature of suffering and happiness, and you can let go very easily as a consequence. Very interesting little thing there, just to show you the causes, the things that enable meditation to happen. So what I will do now is to have a little bit closer look at the idea of right view. I'm going to look at it from one particular angle, just to remind you of the ideas of right view, just to flesh it out a little bit and talk about it a little bit more depth. And this next sutta passage, a small passage from a much longer sutta, is from the middle length sayings of the Buddha, Majjhima Nikaya number 41. It's called the People of Sala. Sala, place in Kosala, I think. And it talks, this whole sutta is about the 10 courses of wholesome action. Dasa Kusala Kamma Pata in Pali. This is like the Buddha's finest break division of morality, and it kind of talks about morality in its three ways of body, speech and mind, and it divides it up into all the various details. And interesting that right view is part of this idea of Kusala Kammapata, the path of wholesome actions. Actually, right view is part of that. It's interesting, isn't it? You don't normally think about right view as an aspect of morality or sila, but here it is actually included in sila itself, because it is very closely related to how we live our lives, etc. So let us have a look at this, what the Buddha has to say about this. And he says, they have right view, an undistorted perspective. There is meaning in giving sacrifice and offerings. There are fruits and results of good and bad deeds. There is an afterlife. There is obligation to mother and father. There are beings reborn spontaneously, and there are ascetics and Brahmins who are well attained and practiced, and who describe the afterlife after realizing it with their own insight. And this is this principle of morality, according to right view aspect of morality. So you have right view, undistorted perspective, abhiparita sannya, something like that. I'm losing it now. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Undistorted perspective. And the idea with that, of course, is the idea that we want to align our view of the world with the way the world actually is. If you don't see the way the world actually is, and your views of the world is contrary to reality, you're going to make bad decisions. It's obvious, it's very obvious that has to be the case. If you think that happiness is over there, well, happiness actually is over here, and this actually is dukkha in the end, well, you're going to pursue dukkha rather than pursuing happiness. If you think that things are permanent when actually they are impermanent, you're going to go for those things that you think are permanent when actually they turn out to be impermanent. So wherever, if you have a wrong perspective on things, it's just like, I like to use the idea of investing on the stock market. It's a kind of very worldly way of looking at it, but this kind of helps to make the point. If you think that a certain stock is going to increase in value, you put all your money into that, but your stockbroker happens to be very badly informed and he gives you all the wrong information. In other words, he has a wrong view. You lose all your money. Your money goes down the drain because of that stupid stockbroker. And then you have an enemy for life after that. So it is wrong view, and wrong view leads to suffering. In this case, small suffering, because losing money is only small suffering. But in the real world, having wrong view leads to enormous suffering, because it means that you pursue life in the wrong way, and you end up with tremendous suffering as a consequence. Losing your money on the stock market is tiny, miny, irrelevant, doesn't matter at all. Losing in the lottery of life, now that is really a really serious problem. But it's the same kind of idea. Right view guides you in the right direction because it is aligned with the way the world actually is. And that is really the point here. Right view is not just an idea that this is Buddhist, and because it is Buddhist is right view by definition. Buddhism is not about setting down a doctrine that you have to believe in because this is what the Buddha said. Buddhism is really about seeing things according to reality. That is what makes it so interesting and what makes it so fascinating. And that is why meditation practice is also so interesting, because it opens up the doors to seeing things according to the way they actually are. So abhiparita sannya, I think it is, an undistorted perspective. That is really what right view is about. And some of the things here are very simple and straightforward, but still they are worthy of contemplation, because some of the things we forget precisely because they seem so basic. And the very first one here, there is meaning in giving sacrifice and offerings. The Pali literally says there is giving sacrifice and offerings, and Bhantasiddhartha has added the word meaning there, which I think is sensible. It makes it more clear what is going on. And this is the idea that generosity is one of the foundations of the spiritual life. And you see this in the suttas in many places. The Buddha very often talks about generosity. It's an important part of the suttas of the spiritual path, and very often it stands at the very beginning. There's something called the graduated discourse when the Buddha often speaks, and then he always starts off by talking about the benefits of generosity in that graduated discourse. It is the opposite of stealing. In the suttas, the idea of virtue or sila is always divided into two parts, and that is the things we shouldn't do and then the things we should do. So there's both avoiding the killing and then having compassion for beings. And then there's avoiding stealing, and the opposite of stealing is actually generosity. One is selfishness, acquiring things for you. The other one is opening yourself up to the world and sharing with everyone. It's very important, and it's actually so important that when you, for example, if you want to get into a deep state of samadhi or a deep state of insight, and one of the characteristics of a person who is ready for that is someone who has no stinginess at all, someone who is completely open-handed, open-hearted, and wants to share with everyone in the world. That is one of the qualities of someone who attains those deep states of samadhi. So if you have a degree of stinginess or selfishness, you're not going to be able to attain samadhi. You have to have that openness of mind. And I'm sure you will understand what I'm talking about, because sometimes when you are generous towards somebody, it feels very spiritual. It feels very beautiful to have that feeling of generosity inside of you. There's something that kind of opens you up to the rest of humanity, the rest of the living world. It's like it's a beautiful quality, this idea of sharing with others. So notice that quality, what it feels like, and straight away you know that here is something very valuable that is really worthwhile pursuing. And this is why that aspect of generosity is so important. And once you get access to some of those feelings of the power of generosity, then you can use that in your meditation practice. And this is what chaga nusati is all about. Chaga is generosity. It basically means giving up, and anusati is a recollection or a reflection, and recollection specifically because it allows you to tap into the things that you have done in the past. So if you have lived well in the past, you can actually remember that and bring back that joy you felt before through your acts of generosity. So it all ties together, how you live your life with being generous. It ties in with your ability to meditate, and that again ties in with your ability to have samadhi and insight. Everything ties together. And this is why the path is so integrated. That is why it is really only one picture with many different aspects to it. That is why one flash of insight when you become a stream mentor actually is sufficient to tie all of these things together, and everything is seen in one kind of bang. Now you understand what the Dhamma is all about. So it is very important for these reasons, and for that reason it is worthwhile pursuing it, and it is worthwhile pursuing it's pursuing continuously. Generosity is something you can always practice almost all the time. Whenever there is an opportunity to do an act of kindness to someone, you are basically being generous. So take every little opportunity, through your speech, through your actions, through even the way you think about other people. Always take the opportunity, if it is there, to be generous, because it has this very powerful transformative effect. So how do we do it in practice? I will give you some examples of some of the things the Buddha said about generosity. I haven't included these suttas because I didn't really know. Sometimes you don't know when you put the suttas together exactly what you're going to talk about, so you cannot just whack it in there. But it's so useful that I think it is worthwhile spending a little bit of time on this. And one of the suttas that I always kind of opened my eyes to the idea of generosity was when King Pasenadi of Kosala, he goes to the Buddha and he asks the Buddha the question, where should a gift be given? Yeah, it's a very good question, because it is very good, because if you are a Buddhist, you are often used to kind of giving to Buddhist causes, yeah, and you think, yeah, I'm going to give to Buddhist causes, but you don't really worry about the rest of the world. The rest of the world is kind of out of mind, yeah, you are a Buddhist, that's where you kind of guide your generosity. Yeah. But of course, the Buddha, when he is asked this question, he does not say, you should just give to the Sangha, or you should just give to me. Yeah, he doesn't say that. It doesn't sound like the Buddha, you should just give to me. It wouldn't be very impressive if he said that. You might turn away from Buddhism if you give that kind of answer, because it sounds very selfish. Well, even if he said you should just give to the Sangha, still it is tainted by selfishness, because it is part of the same kind of group, obviously. So it doesn't say that. And what he says instead, which is very interesting, he says that you should give wherever you feel inspired, or you should give wherever you feel that your heart or your mind is calmed down, and you feel tranquility, inspiration, confidence, and all of these kind of things. That is where you should give. And what that means is that we shouldn't just limit ourselves to one area of generosity. We should always be open to being kind and caring in all kinds of situations, even with animals, yeah, even with people who may be down and out, or whatever it is. We should always have that openness of heart if we can, and share and be kind to others. If we limit, the point about Buddhism is that it is supposed to be a universal religion. It is not a religion that kind of is focused just on certain people who happen to have faith in the Buddha. It is a universal truth. And for that reason, this also affects how we are generous. We should always, wherever you feel inspired, whenever you feel a sense of compassion towards something, that is when you should give. It's a beautiful teaching. And one of the reasons why this is so is that learning about generosity means learning about the benefits that it has for you. Yeah, so when you feel inspired, it's going to have a very big impact on you. So when you feel inspired, you're going to feel the joy, you're going to feel the happiness, you're going to feel the tranquility of the mind that comes with generosity. And because you feel that, it encourages you to give more in the future. You're learning about the benefits right away. But if you become a calculating Buddhist, you have a kind of a spreadsheet, yeah, and you have the amount of merit that comes from each person, and you think, yeah, how can I maximize the merit? Yeah, if I give $10 there, and I give only 50 cents there, and I kind of, you have this kind of big equation, yeah? If you become a calculating Buddhist like that, and they say some people are a bit like that, they calculate, yeah? I wonder, is he an Arahant, or 50% chance that this person is Arahant, 20% chance, and then you kind of have this rigged equation with all the variables and things. If you do that, it destroys the joy, yeah? It destroys the joy, because it becomes a kind of a selfish thing about acquiring the maximum for yourself, and it destroys the entire purpose of generosity. Yeah? So please, cancel those spreadsheets, yeah, wipe them off your laptop or whatever. Don't worry about those. It's the wrong way of thinking about generosity. Yeah. It should be something that is joyful. Yeah. The Buddha says in a nice little sutta, I think it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, Numerical Discourses 7, yeah, he talks about the different ways of being generous. And out of those ways, there's kind of, you know, I'm generous because my family is generous, I'm generous because, kind of, you know, it's good to be nice to people who haven't got any food like monastics, and there's all these kind of reasons for being generous. But the two ways that the Buddha praises for being generous is you do it because, simply because it gives rise to joy. Yeah, you feel happy when you're generous. That's one of them. And the other one, you give because it is an ornament to the mind. It is a parikara for the mind. Parikara means a requisite. It's a requisite for awakening. Yeah, generosity is one of the basic foundations that makes awakening possible. It is a requisite for awakening in that sense. It's a tool that you use to lead you onwards on the path. That is the ideal attitude to have when you're generous. So this is what it is about, and because by giving where you feel inspired, that is how then you kind of allow these things to arise as a consequence. So this is the first question the Buddha is asked by King Pasenadi, and the second question he's asked is, well, where is the most merit? Yeah, and you might have thought that actually we should this question is the same. Maybe you think it should be the same question, yeah? Where you should give and then where there's most merit. It is not the same question, which is very interesting. You should not always give where there's most merit, in other words. The Buddha says the place where there is most merit is when we give to, like people who are very purified, like an arahant or a Buddha or whatever. That is where there is most merit. And the reason why there is most merit there, it doesn't say it in the sutta, but you kind of have to figure it out. But that is because when you give it to someone who is very purified, you're helping a large number of people practicing here. Because arahants are the people who have the most ability to guide others in the world. So you're spreading out. The generosity has a very kind of carry-on effect from one person to the next one. And that is why it creates so much happiness in the world. That's why it is a very powerful act of generosity. But it's interesting that these are two different questions. Where is the most merit and where you should give are not the same thing. Ideally, you want to give to arahants, yeah? If you don't like arahants and don't want to give to them, it's not ideal, yeah? I hate arahants, I wouldn't recommend that perception. So sometimes, you know, that is the right thing to do. Yeah, if you feel inspired or whatever, then you give it to the Sangha, or often giving to the Sangha is better than giving to arahants, because you don't really know who the arahants are anyway, so give to the Sangha. It's a wonderful thing to do, of course, but don't limit yourself to that. Open up your heart. Open up your heart to the whole world and see where your inspiration arises. That is the right place to give. So that is one of the suttas that always kind of made an impact on me when I was reading it. There was some other examples of suttas that I found that were interesting and made an impact on me was the degree to which we should pursue giving and generosity. And for example, the Buddha says that if you are a monastic, you should share even the contents of your alms bowl. Yeah, so if you have been given something that is special that some other monk doesn't have, you share it with them. Why? Because the Buddha says that if you knew the power of generosity, you wouldn't have a single meal without sharing with someone else. Yeah, because it is so powerful. Very beautiful. Yeah, so you try always to share any possibility. The Buddha says that if you have washed your bowl, you have a little bit of kind of scraps left in the bottom, if you throw out that dishwashing water with little kind of rice grains in it, and you just think about the little insects that might live off those rice grains, already you're making good karma. Already you're practicing generosity in the right way. Yeah, it's so easy to practice generosity. It's just a matter of attitude. You can either throw out those rice grains mindlessly, or you can think, may this be for those little creatures in the ground. You can maybe put it even in a place where it is more likely they will be able to eat it. Yeah? Straight away, the difference is, in one case, you're not making any good karma at all. It doesn't support your meditation, doesn't do anything good for you. In the other case, it becomes a source to support you in your spiritual life. Just with a slight change in intention, a slightly different way of thinking. That's all it takes sometimes. Isn't that kind of fascinating? It's just the state of mind that is the difference, really. Because you're going to throw away those rice grains anyway. The state of mind is what makes a difference, whether it is something useful or useless. And our whole life is like that. When you speak to other people, do you speak in a way whereby you're trying to give people the gift of your words? Or do you speak in a way where you don't really think about it? If you speak in a way whereby you're trying to give people the gift of your speech, then every time you open your mouth, it's an opportunity to do something that enhances your practice. Yeah, so when you start using this idea of generosity in the right way, there are so many opportunities to live the spiritual life to good effect. That is a little bit for you about the idea of generosity. So please don't underestimate these things. Don't think that you have gone a long way on the path. You are finished with the basics. Yeah. So generosity is now over. It is never over. In fact, it's the other way around. The further down the path you are, the more generous you become. And this is one of the ways of knowing whether somebody actually has gone a long way on the path is to look at their generosity. Very generous people are people who are spiritually have gone a long way spiritually. Yeah. One of the ways of knowing that. Okay. So let's leave that one aside, and let's move on to the next one, which is that there are fruits and results of good and bad deeds. And this is the idea of karma in Buddhism, that how we live our life actually matters. And we have already seen that in part through the act of giving. The act of giving, of course, is a good deed, and it leads to good fruits and good results. And this is a very important part of the Buddhist outlook. And it has many aspects to it, and the usual way that people think about this is that we think about the idea of karma, as you do good in this life, and as a consequence you have good results in a future life. But it is not all that useful. It is useful in a sense to know that you might be kind of looked well after you die and all that. That's kind of nice, of course, that's useful in one sense. But actually it is not so useful for the spiritual practice in this life. And so there is one important way of looking at this, which is the idea that karma does not only have results in future life, but it also has results in this very life itself. The Buddha talks about three kinds of results of karma: the result that happened in this life, the result that happened in the next life, and the result that happens in subsequent lives after that. But the most interesting one is the result in this life, because at least for our immediate practice. And the way that you know that you're making good karma in this life, this is the way I regard this, is to feel what it feels like to do an act of kindness. And if you are careful, if you really are coming from kindness inside, and you do something kind towards someone else, an act of generosity, an act of right speech, an act of compassion, even a kind thought, if you look at how that affects you emotionally and feeling-wise, you tend to feel good about it straight away. And this is the idea of karma in this very life. You feel good about yourself when you live well. So the idea here is, if you start to feel the connection between your intention and how you feel about yourself, if you have an immediate experience of that, you start to understand what karma is about. And it's very encouraging for living well. It really encourages you, because you can actually see the connection straight away. And what this means, and this is important to understand what this actually means, it means that, of course, you have then a kind of happiness, and of course the happiness fades away again afterwards. It's not kind of permanently there, but it leaves an imprint on the mind. It leaves something, a residue in the stream of consciousness. And later on you can reflect back on that. You can use it in your meditation practice as part of the idea of Chaga Anusati I just mentioned, Sila Anusati, the recollection of our conduct and our habits, good conduct and good habits. It all becomes part and parcel of this whole practice, the gradual training as we move towards awakening and deep meditation. And what happens is that it is cumulative. So you do one act of kindness, and you do another one, and then the amount of good energy, if you like, or the good karma, or the goodness that you feel about yourself accumulates. So you are, in a sense, you are lifting your mind up, or you are untethering your mind from all the kind of heavy things that hold it down, and you allow the mind to soar. The mind becomes more bright, more light, more buoyant, more ability to focus in a meditation practice. All of these good qualities gradually increase as you're able to live in a good way and do good actions, especially if you do it all the time and continuously without break. And exactly the same thing with the bad acts. If you are able to avoid the bad acts, it's exactly the same thing, because by avoiding the bad acts, and if you do something bad towards someone, you may feel bad about yourself. You avoid that feeling bad about yourself because you did something bad. And feeling bad about yourself, sometimes it can just be a slight dimming of the brightness of your mind. That's all it is sometimes. Because it's like you judge yourself in a negative way, and then you dim the lights of the mind. And that is exactly what you want to avoid. So this is the idea behind this idea of karma. The idea that in this right now, you are doing something to your mind, and your mind is transformed right here in this lifetime through the way you live. That is the best way to understand karma, because it is very obvious and it's very easy to understand. And this then is also the foundation and source for understanding how karma goes from one life to the next one. It's very easy, simple, because if you build up a bright and pure mind in this life, when you die, well, that's where you continue in your next life. So you get reborn in a state that accords with that, how you have built up your mind in this life. That is how kind of karma gets transferred from one life to the next one. And of course, then you can continue practicing in that future life as a consequence. This is the idea of karma and living in the right way, and how it affects your spiritual practice. So this is why, again, it is so important to get this right, because it becomes a very powerful thing in your spiritual practice. Then we have the next one, which is that there is an afterlife, there is a rebirth. Iddaloka, paraloka. Iddaloka means this world, paraloka is the other world. Iddangva hurangva. So this is the idea that there is such a thing as rebirth. Why is that part of right view? And one of the reasons it is part of right view, because this is directly about the idea of suffering. The noble truth of suffering, if you go back to the four noble truths, one way of understanding that noble truth, first one, is to understand the idea of rebirth. If you understand the idea of rebirth in the right way, it is just this perpetual moving on without any purpose, without going anywhere in particular, without any goal in sight, just going around for the sake of going around. It's like coming back to this retreat center, Jhana Grove, every year for eternity, and always having exactly the same meditation every time. That's what samsara is like. Is that satisfactory?
And the same
jokes, and they're hearing the same jokes every time, exactly. After a while, imagine if that happens, and your meditation never really goes anywhere, there's no purpose, you're not heading anywhere, you just have to come back again and again and again. After a few hundred years, you had enough, but after a few hundred years, you still have to continue for more hundred years, and there's no end on the horizon. And that is kind of the good part of samsara. it's bad news. It's really bad news. That's the good part. And it gets worse from there. So this is the problem with rebirth. And you have to understand it in the right way. And when you understand it in the right way, then you understand something very profound about the idea of suffering and why it is so problematic. This is one of the, also part of this is also what I've been talking about before, the sensual world, the world of the five senses that we are so enmeshed in, that we are embedded in, immersed in at all times, pretty much as all, for the most part, what we know about is the five sense world, because that is what we start off with first thing in the morning, and it's there with us all the time. Even when we sleep at night, you dream about that five sense world. We're completely enclosed in this, and we don't really know anything apart from it. So it's very useful to remember the dangers in that five sense world, why it is so problematic, because it is in that five sense world that we attach to things. This is where we crave things, and we crave things and we attach to things that are inherently problematic, that is always going to be taken away from us, always going to have to be removed. And this is why this is so terrible. And we don't have any choice about it. It's not as if you can just say, I'm not going to attach anymore or crave anymore. You have to attach. It's not something you can't have any choice about. And the reason why you haven't got any choice about it is because you have a sense of self. It is inherent in the sense of self that you have to attach. Why is that? It's actually quite useful to understand why that is the case, why attachment is not optional if you have a sense of self. And the reason is because if you have a sense of self, that sense of self, by definition, has to have certain qualities. There's something that you relate to inside of you that is that self. It could be the knowing, perhaps. It could be the doer. It could be certain perceptions that you have. This feels like me. Sometimes you wake up in the morning, you don't feel yourself. Then you have some idea what your sense of self is all about, because It is not that feeling you have that morning when you don't feel like you. Yeah, so that gives you some idea of this sense of self that you have. It's related to certain aspects of our experience, of our inner experience. So because you take these to be yourself, by definition, you're going to be attached to them. Yeah, that's why when you wake up in the morning, you don't feel yourself, you feel a bit kind of dodgy, because it's a bit uncomfortable. So by definition, you have to be attached to those things because they are you. And if what is you gets taken away, well, that is very unpleasant, because this is who you are. So by definition, you're going to be attached to those things that are yourself. And that sense of self, it doesn't stop with the inner feeling, because that sense of self also then leaks into the outer world, because the outer world is where that sense of self extends itself to find happiness, to find the joys, to be able to live out the doing that actually is part of who you take to be yourself. So it extends out its tentacles into the external world. So as long as you have that sense of self inside, you're going to attach to things in this world. There is no choice about it. And this is why, as long as you live in the five sense world, and that is all you have, and you know you're going to attach to that, but you also know that that world is inherently problematic, because it always changes. It is never stable. It always ends in death, one way or another. Yeah, because of that, you know you are in serious trouble. You know that you're asking for dukkha, for suffering, by having all of these attachments in that world. There's no choice in this world. You're going to suffer. And for this reason, we have our mind states are so very up and down. Yeah, one day you're happy, then suddenly one day you are miserable. And the mind fluctuates like this. And this is precisely because of our relationship with that world that is so impermanent, so unreliable, so out of control, and always going to let you down one way or the other. So this is a very important part of this idea of right view. Yeah, seeing the world in the right way, understanding its limitations. Because once you do that, you kind of feel you had enough of that world. You want to withdraw from it. Let me find something else. And this is why the Buddha talks about the refuge being within, being island unto yourself. Take the Dhamma as your island. Because when you do your meditation practice, you become peaceful inside. That is really the only time when you are secluded from that external world, which is so problematic, and you find some other happiness that is more accessible, more stable, and more not as impermanent and problematic as the happiness outside. And you can see, if you take that view very seriously, you can see why it is so easy then to give up the external world. If you really understand how problematic it is, easy to give it up. It's like a hot piece of coal. You just bang, you let go of it. And then, of course, meditation happens quite fast as a consequence. So this idea of right view, understanding this, is so important. And of course, when you come to rebirth, we're actually talking about rebirth here, then this whole thing becomes even more significant. If there is no rebirth, you may think, okay, it doesn't matter so much, I only got these years on this planet anyway, and then it's all finished, it's all kind of over with, kind of a modern materialistic outlook. It's not such a big deal. But if there is rebirth, this is even more important. The Buddha says there's one thing that we own. Yeah, all of these other things in life are impermanent, always changing. They are like borrowed goods, the Buddha says. They are kind of really incredibly unreliable. Before you know it, you have to give it all back. But there's one thing that we own. The Buddha says we are the owners of our karma. In other words, you are the owner of the mind that you purify and you brighten and you make into a positive mental state. That is what you really own. You own that, because that is what you take with you into the future when you pass away. That is what you carry with you from one life to the next one, long term into the future. Ultimately, you don't even own that, because ultimately even that will change. But you are far more an owner of your karma than you are of all the external things around you. And again, that karma is just the mind that you build up. You build up with spiritual qualities in this life. The more you build it up with spiritual qualities, the more purified and bright and delightful that mind is, the more you have built up something that you can carry with you from life to life, and that you can actually be something real. That is why this is the real refuge, because it takes you with you. You go with it from life to life. Imagine if you have only lived for the material things of the world, all the worldly things. Imagine if all we have done is to kind of make up a large fortune in life, amass educational titles, amass social standing, all of these things that people really go for in this world that are so important to them. Imagine if this is all you have done, yeah? And then you come to the end of your life, you're about to die. How do you feel? Everything you have done in this world is connected to this world. Now you are about to die. You have to give up everything. Everything you have done seems pointless at this particular point. Why did I waste my time on all of these things? And now I have to give it all up. You feel confused. You feel uncertain. You feel you have wasted your time on this planet. You had a chance to do something more. You had a chance to live a spiritual existence, to do something for your heart, for your mind, to develop something for the future. But all you have done is things that belong to this world. Now you're dying. You have to give it everything up again. The feeling is a terrible feeling because of course, you're going to be attached to those things because you spent all your energy doing those things to build them up. You're going to be attached to them. And now you're forced to give it all up again. It's a terrible way of living. It's a terrible way of dying because everything seems so pointless. And what happens is actually it's much worse than that. And the reason why it is worse than that, because if everything that matters to you are the things of this world, and that is what is important, and you have no idea of a spiritual practice, it means that you also take shortcuts as you accumulate all of these worldly things, fame and social status, whatever it is. You also take shortcuts with your precepts. You don't worry about precepts at all very often. You cheat people a little bit, you lie a little bit here and there. So not only have you done things that have to be given up when you die, but actually you have also done something very bad to your mind in the consequence. So when you die, your mental state is actually worse than when you came into this world. So you're not only are you not taking anything with you, that which you are taking with you is in a worse shape than when you started out in this life. That makes you feel really doubly bad. Yeah, it makes the whole thing seem really terrible. And this is a problem with having this materialistic outlook. So then, this is why rebirth matters. This is why it is so important, because you start to think about things in a different way. You start to think about things in the long term. You start to think in terms of long-term investment, where real happiness actually lies. And you start to invest in your spiritual life, in your mind, in all the good qualities instead. And what that means is that you change your idea of what is important in life. Instead of chasing all of these empty results, all these empty aims, all these empty purposes in life, yeah, a kind of material well-being or social status or educational prowess or whatever it is, all of that, because these things are so empty at the end of the day, you start looking instead at the process rather than the results. The process of how to get to those results. How do I live in the process of achieving the things that I achieve in life? How do I treat the people around me? I know this is sometimes easy to say, but this is really where the path is at. It's easy to say because sometimes the worldly life, it pushes you to do things and you are, you know, you have to get results and all these kind of things. Otherwise, you might lose your job and all of these things. But this is really what the spiritual path is about. Getting the process right. Not being too concerned about the results. Because that process is what, in the long term, is going to give you real meaning and real purpose. So that is the idea of rebirth and why it matters. So this is a right view, and why it is an important part of right view. So let's have a quick look at the last little bits of right view here. The next one is there is obligation to mother and father. Yeah, so this is the idea that the Pali just says there is mother and father, but I think putting obligation in there makes it kind of more understandable what is going on. And the idea with this is just that our parents are a very powerful field of merit. So if you're able to treat your parents well, it means that you're going to make a lot of good karma. You're going to feel very good about yourself as a consequence. And this is why it is in there. Useful to know. So when we, if you have an opportunity to do something right with your parents, it is always a good thing to do. Even after they have passed away, you can still do some good things, like do something on their behalf and wish them well and these things. But certainly when they are alive, if your parents are still alive, you have that opportunity, please take it, because it is going to be very powerful for your spiritual practice. Don't make it into a burden. If you make it into a burden, it becomes not very joyful and happy. Make it into something positive. Try to remember that your parents are worthy of that support. Try to remember all the things they have done for you as when you were a child, how they taught you so much. The Buddha calls the parents the Pubbacharya, which means the first teachers, the prior teachers that we have. So much of the things that we know in our life, we learn from our parents. They taught us all the basics that we need to survive. And remember the love that the parents have for the children. The parents are not going to be perfect. They have probably made lots of mistakes as well. But still, they have always been there when you needed them. Always been there supporting you. And what an astonishing thing that is. You are the only person in the world that your parents would look after in that way. You and your siblings. Everyone else is kind of irrelevant to the parents. You are kind of been the center of the focus and attention for many, many years. And what an amazing thing that is. In this way, you learn to deal with your parents in a way that shouldn't feel like an obligation. If it does, it destroys too much of that beauty. But make it into something positive, and then it becomes much more powerful as an act of kindness. Then you have beings that are reborn spontaneously, and this is probably the least important of these aspects of right view. It doesn't occur in some of the other suttas in the parallels in Chinese. I think this is actually missing. This seems to be unique to the Pali. But the idea is just that it extends the scope of samsaric existence to all kind of beings and all kind of realms, because you need to have spontaneous rebirth in some of these realms, like the Devaloka, etc. And the last one is that there is ascetics and Brahmins who are well attained and practiced, who describe the afterlife after realizing it with their own insight. So this is just the view, the idea that there are people in the world who practice well. There are Buddhas, there may be Arahants and Aryas still around in the present day. Just having that faith, that ability to see goodness, kindness, profundity, insight, calm, peace, all of these qualities, to be able to see them when they arise is an incredibly, incredible blessing. So focus on that as well. And the way to strengthen that quality in you, that sense of faith and confidence that there are people who have these qualities, is really to do things like reading the suttas and then listening to talks perhaps that deal with those suttas, and then from that, in that way, building up that confidence that there are people with special insights in this world, especially the Buddha himself, because the Buddha is the root Kalyanamitta, the Mula Kalyanamitta, the root Kalyanamitta. Mula is root in Pali, root Kalyanamitta on the spiritual path. So if you can gain that confidence in the Buddha, it's going to be very, very powerful. There are people who have no confidence in spiritual teachers. It's quite a common thing in the world. And these are people who are basically lost as far as the spiritual path is concerned. For them, there is only the worldly things, and they will have very poor lives for that reason, at least from the spiritual point of view, when you come from this particular point of view. So it's very important to have that a sense of confidence in something more. This is what makes life really livable, really purposeful, really useful. And it makes you, instead of walking through the dry desert of life, it means you are in a plush, in a really nice oasis with a nice cool water and all these kind of things instead. And you feel nourished, and you feel good because you have all this beautiful nourishment that gives you a real sense of purpose in life. And that is what that is about. Okay, so that is a little bit about right view. There's lots more to be said about right view, but I think that is enough, at least to give you a good idea of what is going on. So that is all for this morning. And this afternoon we're going to be talking about the Anapanasati Sutta, the mindfulness of breathing, which is more about Satipatthana practice. So we'll see you back again at 3 o'clock this afternoon.